It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee today. The South is known for manners.
Like ships that go out to sea, I spoon my soup away from me.
But Southern hospitality means a lot more than just table etiquette. Today we're going to get three views on how to have grace and share really good food later this hour. But first, the collapse of I-85 in Atlanta will reverberate for months.
Every hour that you're delayed in traffic, you're losing productivity, you're losing potential wages, your employer is losing potential productivity, which means potential revenue.
I hear your first thoughts.
Hey, my name is DJ Jennings, and I live in Tucker, Georgia. My thought is that we should use this opportunity to take the lemon we've been handed and make lemonade, and use the closed lanes of the highway as a temporary pop-up park, similar to the Beltline. I've created a Facebook page, Lemonade Linear Park is how you get there. I'd love to see something positive come out of this otherwise very negative situation.
That's an idea. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457, 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, last month, researchers at Georgia Tech announced they had been chosen by NASA for a special new project. Their mission? To better understand radiation on other planets and to develop spacesuits to protect astronauts from whatever they may encounter out there. With me now is Thomas Orlando, a director at Georgia Tech's Center for Space Technology and Research. He's leading the team called REVEALS, which will be working with NASA on this. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm guessing REVEALS stands for something.
Yes, it's an acronym that we spent some time developing. It's called Radiation Effects on Volatiles and Exploration of Asteroids and Lunar Surfaces.
Cool. Okay. So spacesuits that NASA has now, they already protect against radiation, right? Like there's cosmic radiation out in interplanetary space where we do spacewalks now. What are you doing that's different?
Well, there are a number of issues that are remain with the current spacesuits. One of the co-investigators on our REVEALS team is a former astronaut. His name is Stephen Robinson. He's the chair of the Aerospace Engineering Department at the University of California in Davis. And so one of the things that we discussed is what are the real issues that the astronauts experience when on a spacewalk. And radiation comes in many forms. One of the things they care a lot about is bombardment by micrometeorites and the potential penetration of the micrometeorites into the spacesuits.
So you're talking about like little like dust particles that are moving at speeds so fast they could tear through your stuff?
Yeah, exactly. They're essentially bullets, and so if they penetrate the spacesuit or mechanically degrade them, then this is a very serious issue for the astronauts. So we're looking at making them better with regard to their mechanical stability. In essence, it's making better materials that would be good for astronauts, as well as bulletproof vests. The other thing that's different is we would like to make them so that they have a pretty high electrical conductivity, because another issue with regard to safety that the astronauts experience, particularly if they're walking on the moon, is the uptake and clinging of dust from electrostatics. And then the dust gets into the seals that are on their helmet and gloves. And if you have a leak, that's a problem. And so we want to make suits that sort of repel the dust. And the last thing we would like to do is integrate within the material a material that gives you very good conductivity for electricity. And this could be used to monitor the radiation or the ionizing radiation that the astronauts may be bombarded with. And you mentioned this, a cosmic ray, for example, or the solar wind, which is mostly electrons and protons hitting them. They'd like to know this and what the dose is while they're walking on the moon surface, or if we go to Mars on the moons of Mars, which would be Phobos and Deimos.
Yeah, so personed space flight has sort of stalled at NASA for quite some time. Are there any specific missions for which they are thinking about these new suits and materials, places where other planetary bodies where people might go eventually?
So the primary emphasis on human exploration has been near-Earth objects, and this would primarily be going back to the moon. And there is a very big push to go back to Mars and, you know, potentially have human explorations of the Mars surface. There's the moons of Mars, which are Phobos and Deimos, which is, I already mentioned. They would be potential destinations. My opinion
why,
is...
Why would we want to go there? I mean, other than the obvious, which is that it would be awesome.
Well, there's a continued interest on the potential that Mars itself may have harbored life or been a habitat
sure,
where
yeah.
You know, primitive life forms could have existed. So, you know,
but the moons?
So the moons are sort of outposts and in sort of they're maybe easier to get to and. At least our moon is the closest, obviously, and it's probably the best place to go to map out the scenarios and the technologies and beta testing technologies for explorations at further distances. So my opinion is the moon may be a very good destination so you can test the infrastructure and protocols for exploration at more distant destinations.
We're talking to Thomas Orlando. He's a director at the Georgia Tech Center for Space Technology and Research. He is leading a team that has recently landed a NASA contract to work on a new generation of spacesuit and materials that will shield astronauts and I suppose also equipment and such from radiation and other hazards that lie out there in interstellar space and in near-Earth planetary bodies. Pretty cool stuff. I've looked at your research. You're also looking at harnessing some of these forces that we've been talking about to generate resources for astronauts, water.
Yeah, this is a very big emphasis of the program. In fact, we've been doing research for NASA for a number of years as a part of a big program at Johns Hopkins University in the Applied Physics Laboratory tied to Johns Hopkins. The idea is to understand what happens when the solar wind, which is primarily protons and electrons, interact with the regolith or the surface of the moons or the surface of asteroids. And in particular, we're trying to understand whether or not the proton or the solar wind produces water and whether or not that water can be captured and utilized as water, as a resource for the human exploration component. In addition to water, there's hydrocarbons and carbon on the surfaces, and so there's a question of whether or not methane could also be produced. And in that case, that would also be a very useful resource.
This is as a fuel.
As a fuel, yes. Yeah. This is a big concern because water is necessary to sustain life, and water could, in principle, also be utilized as a fuel if you split it into hydrogen and oxygen. But the probability of the astronauts bringing large volumes of water to the surface is low, and this is not the paradigm that one would follow for exploration. They would like to have in-situ resources that you could use. So we have a very big emphasis on trying to understand the physics involved in the radiation processing of the regolith to see if it produces resources that could be captured and utilized.
Yeah, I would love to hear you talk about how solar wind could make water, but this is a radio show and we have mere moments left. I'm really curious about that, though. But the Georgia Tech Center for Space Technology and Research, as I understand, this was created somewhat with the intent of trying to get some more space business to Georgia. It tends to go a lot of it to the state, to our southern border. How did you land this contract with NASA?
Okay, so you pointed out something that is quite important. So C-STAR is located at Georgia Institute of Technology, but it's a very multidisciplinary center that involves a lot of scientists, engineers, and policy folks. And the intention of that enterprise is to bring a lot of work in the space enterprise to the Southeast. We are teaming with folks at the Florida Space Institute and the University of Central Florida and the Space Enterprise in Florida. And we have an overall intention through C-STAR to help Georgia become an economically viable enterprise in space technology and space exploration. The reveals came about as sort of a coalition of people within tech and within C-STAR got together and said, okay, we're going to focus on the space weathering component and then coupled to other universities throughout the United States and then a couple of other enterprises in Europe. So it's a global enterprise and with a really big emphasis on space weathering.
Space weathering is what you're talking about with these micrometeorites, tiny particles that can rip through your suit and through your cells and I'm sure all kinds of other horrible things,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so space weathering is a general term. It also involves what happens when the solar radiation, but in this case it would typically be termed the solar wind, interacts with the materials, which is electrons and protons, and it's sort of this weak plasma. And
solar radiation solar wind?
Well, because of the if you look at how the radiation emanates from the sun, it's constantly emanating from the sun, and then there's solar bursts too. When there's these solar flare events, those are the ones that are particularly dangerous, and we tend to not pay attention to it because Earth has a very strong magnetosphere, and it deflects most of the solar radiation. In fact, without it, we wouldn't be talking. We wouldn't exist. And then it focuses the radiation to the poles. And this is the source of the auroras that are showing up, the very nice light shows on the northern and southern hemisphere. And it's called solar wind because it propagates outward and it bathes all of the planetary bodies. And those with magnetospheres are protected and those without are not. Now, the moon turns out to be outside of our magnetosphere. So it feels the full brunt of the solar wind. This is the same for asteroids. And so they're often referred to as unprotected airless bodies. And these are the ones that are going to be mostly susceptible to radiation processing from the solar wind. And so we have a very big emphasis on trying to understand that, within our solar system and other solar systems.
Indeed. Space travel continues to be much more complicated than it looks in the movies. Mm-hmm. Thomas Orlando, in 30 seconds, what's in it for you in terms of space travel? What are you trying to find out there, personally?
Personally, I think it's, space remains the final frontier for exploration. So it's really nice to be engaged in trying to develop new technologies and understand some of the physics and chemistry and the fundamental science issues associated with the space travel and unraveling details that might allow humans to do this on a more routine basis.
It's Thomas Orlando, a director at Georgia Tech Center for Space Technology and Research. His research team will soon be working with NASA to develop radiation-proof spacesuits and other things for astronauts and space travel. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Good luck. Just ahead, how should the law classify white supremacists? But first, we're going to get ourselves a good old lesson on the ways of Southern hospitality. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Celeste Headley, and this is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Celeste Headley. I'm not from the South, but one of the things that I noticed when I first moved here was that whole Southern hospitality thing. That's really a thing. It's a generosity thing. It's a food thing. It is arguably a passive aggression thing. Now it turns out that Georgia leads Southern states in hospitality. That's according to a recent survey from the travel rental website Twitty. What does Southern hospitality really mean? For more on that, I am joined by College of Charleston professor Gibbs Knotts. He's co-author of the new book, The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of Its People. Gibbs, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is April McLean. She works at the Athens-based Etiquette School. Perfectly polished. Hey, April.
Hello. Great being here today.
And also with me in the Macon studio is Elfrida Lockett. She's the executive chef at Mima's restaurant in Macon. Good to have you, Elfrida.
Yes, good to be here.
Good to have everybody. Gibbs, you want to define Southern hospitality?
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely politeness and manners, but it's also looking people in the eye, telling people to have a nice day. You mentioned food. It's an important part of it, welcoming people to your home. We conducted some focus groups with both white and black Southerners to write our book, and hospitality was one of the first things they mentioned when we asked them what being Southern meant to them.
How do you see it fitting into the broader Southern identity?
So it's an important part. I mean, that's one of the things that really brings both African Americans and whites in the South together. There's a lot that divides, obviously, those two main racial groups in the South. Certainly looking at, we found, you know, remembrance of the Civil War and the Confederate flag and talking about race relations, there were certainly a lot of differences. But when it came to food and hospitality and manners, there were a lot of similarities. A lot of people that said, look, you know, compared to other parts of the country, this is where I want to be, and it's a lot different down here. And they really noticed it when they traveled outside of the South or when they interacted with people from outside the South.
Elfrida, how do you define Southern hospitality?
Well, I define Southern hospitality as engaging and recognizing the customer or the person or the family member when they come in by telling them they're welcome. Not only telling them, but making them feel welcome.
Okay. Now, April, how do you define it? April McLean.
Well, they're right on the money. Being a Southerner truly is the ability to make a complete stranger feel like part of your family in the first 10 minutes that you meet them. Maybe it's with that warm smile, that friendly handshake, but it truly is being acknowledged. And that's our thing in Georgia. We immediately acknowledge you in a world that's gotten so fast and there's no time for that. I think that's what those from, I would say, away really perceive as Southern hospitality. It is our ability to immediately have a sincere engagement.
But is there not an aspect to it, April, that is a little bit less benign? One of the things that really struck me when I first moved to Macon from Boston, of all places, about 4.5 years ago, was when people would say, bless your heart, to mean something that was not at all nice. Like, oh, bless your heart is code for you're stupid.
Well, there are things we say, those things that drive us always sometimes bite us in the backside. So we have to be a little bit aware of when and why we say these things. But I have an opportunity to interface with about 3,000 college students a month, and I see about 650 fifth through 12th graders every 10 days. And what we truly have found is the South is not based on those little sayings, but it's that ability to build self-confidence, not only in ourselves, but in others. And that really is a key to success in your family, in your friends, in your profession. And being from a very small town, I grew up in Millen, Georgia. On a good day, there's probably 2,500 people there. I've been in Athens for about 25 years. But I do know that learning from others and building self-confidence is the key to just a bright future and the ability to interface with people that you've never seen before and make immediate friends.
No doubt. Gibbs, question to you. Is there a dark side to Southern hospitality, a certain passive aggression?
So I think so. I mean, I think there's definitely an element there. You know, we made sure we talked about the dark side of Southern identity and took some of our readers through the history of people like George Wallace, who really kind of, protested the changes, the desegregation coming from the federal government and really rallied white Southerners. You know, even somebody like Dylan Roof more recently, the person who went in and shot the folks at Emmanuel AME Church as they were there in in a Bible study, you know, he appeared with the Confederate flag. He had this sort of perverse type of Southern identity. And so I think there is an element to that, but I think it would be a mistake to focus too much on that because, you know, again, the people that we talked to genuinely believed and made an effort to talk about how it was important to be welcoming, to look people in the eye, to really where hospitality was an important part of their identity as Southerners.
I'm speaking with College of Charleston professor Gibbs Knotts. Also with us is April McLean of the Athens-based Etiquette School Perfectly Polished. And with me in the GPB Macon studio is Elfrida Lockett, executive chef at Meemaw's in Macon. We are talking about Southern hospitality. A website recently said that Georgia is the most hospitable of all Southern states. We're talking about exactly what that means and where that maybe comes from. Elfrida, you touched on earlier about how what hospitality means in terms of service at your restaurant. Let's talk about it in the food itself, and I wonder if you couldn't first just set the scene. Like, what are your top-selling dishes? What do you do at Meemaw's?
Some of my top-selling dishes are the meatloaf and mashed potatoes, macaroni and cheese, beef tips and rice, oxtails,
yeah,
and those, and turnips and collards.
So some people would call that just Southern food. I imagine you would call it soul food. Do you see a meaningful distinction?
Yes, I say Southern style food, and all of it is good for the soul, but it's how you prepare it. And I take ownership of preparing it where all people, all nationality, is not overly seasoned. It's just seasoned to a point, and then you take it to the next degree.
So that's one of the things that is hospitable about that food, that, like, it's sort of entry level. You know, it's a you can take the little hot sauce or whatever you've got on the table and customize it to whatever you want. What else makes that food intrinsically hospitable?
The aroma, the looks, the color, the consistency of it, the texture of it. It's just immaculate. When we plate our food and present it to you and it's in front of you, you go like, wow, gosh, I want to dive into this.
I am so hungry. Gibbs, what's your take on that? Are there aspects of these classic Southern soul food dishes that are intrinsically hospitable in some way? I mean, sometimes people call these things like macaroni and cheese comfort food, as though they do evoke some kind of universal emotional response.
Absolutely. I'm getting very hungry here just hearing about all this. But I tell you, look, a lot of the tradition in the South is to have food that was grown. I mean, sometimes it was, you know, prepared by folks that didn't have a lot of money, and they kind of had to be creative with how they created flavors and put things together. And so there is an element, you know, it was farm to table before farm to table became all the rage.
Absolutely. Listeners, we always love hearing from you. When you hear the phrase Southern hospitality, what comes to mind for you? You can call us at 404-594-57. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can look us up on Facebook. April McLean of the Athens-based Etiquette School, Perfectly Polished. The Southern Belle archetype is one that has been much discussed. Do you see something of value there? Is that something you identify with?
Oh, absolutely. And we also, about 15 years ago, we purchased the Protocol School of Washington's Children's Division. And now people from all over the world come to Athens, Georgia for 5 days to get their certification to teach manners, etiquette, and leadership. So what I think that says, that manners just is not about the South anymore. People from Dubai, Turkey, Canada, Wyoming, Washington want to know the foundation of how to treat people and to engage people and to make a relationship. And I truly believe that manners is just not about the food, but it's what you do around the food. Mm-hmm. It's communication. And in a day where the cell phone dominates our days and we've forgotten how to communicate, people are just longing for those times that they can sit and talk to someone. So for people to be coming from all over the world to want to know how to go back to their community and teach these Southern elements, it's not so Southern anymore.
Indeed. Some of the times when I feel most Northeastern living in Macon is when I'm sort of instinctively resistant to stranger conversation, to talking to people in the grocery store checkout line or at the post office or what have you. I really sometimes don't want to expend, I guess I'm an introvert, and I suppose I don't want to expend that energy, and I just want to sort of bury myself in my phone. And that's kind of like one of the things about myself that I like the least. Does anyone else ever have that tendency to kind of want to shy away from those sort of very Southern public interactions? And if so, how do you overcome it? Anybody?
I think I'm with you, Adam. You know, I'm a teacher, so I'm up with students a lot. And sometimes, you know, on the way to the gym, I just want to listen to my radio or listen to my music and walk to the gym across our beautiful campus. But, you know, I think you need to realize that, you know, you're in a place where, you know, interacting and greeting people is part of the culture. And there's a lot of value that can come from, not hiding in your cell phone all day.
Elfrieda, do you ever struggle to have the energy to sort of have that kind of outgoing attitude that is really demanded of that sort of Southern hospitality thing?
Well, I haven't experienced it as of yet because whenever I get a break, I would go out and sit with my customers and have a conversation with them and engage, as I said before, conversation about this particular item or that, or they can ask me questions. I love people. I never meet a stranger. And so maybe they might want me to leave their place so they can be, you know, alone or whatever for a moment. But I always ask, is it okay? Can I sit with you for a moment?
Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay, Elfrieda, do you buy the idea that Georgia is the most hospitable of Southern hospitality states?
I think it is one of the most. I really can embrace that idea by traveling and going to other places. Georgia is one of the tops.
Where would you put number two? And don't say South Carolina just because we have someone from Charleston here.
I was going to say South Carolina.
Oh, okay, all right.
Thank you.
I think South Carolina's great.
Gibb, same question to you.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised. I mean, Georgia's had so much in-migration, and Atlanta's grown so much that, you know, it surprises me a little bit. But look, Atlanta's always tried to bill itself as the capital of the New South, and it's clearly in the Deep South, which are, you know, those five states, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. So as long as it rests with one of those five Deep South states, that's kind of what I would expect.
April McLean, you're in Athens, and that's another one of these southern cities that has an enormous percentage of people coming from outside, from all over the world. Has that affected its southern hospitality vibe?
I truly believe that it's just grown that vibe. Mm-hmm. We all say that we should wear T-shirts here in Athens, Georgia, that say everybody wants to be us, because when people come here, there's just such a balance of the old and the new, that whether you're a professor or a student here at the University of Georgia, there is a high percentage that stay here, that make their families here, find a job here. It's very close to Atlanta. And I think that is the beauty of the whole state of Georgia, mm-hmm. is that it is such a doable state to raise families, to get to an airport, to have the history just grounded in those traditions. I do believe, if my history comes back right, we were the fourth state to be placed, and we're grounded in tradition. And I do believe about 1788. So we go way, way back in our families modeling those expectations. And I do believe Athens, Georgia has just embraced that, and everybody loves Athens. So it is a great Southern melting pot, because we do have lots of people from lots of different places here, but they all love what we would say Southern hospitality, because everybody likes to be engaged, and they like to be respected, and most of all, they love to laugh. And Georgia is a very happy place. And if you spend your days on that fast track, at the end of the day, it's just fun to kind of enjoy life it is. And we Southerners are known to enjoy life as it is.
All right, fantastic. Listeners, I want to go ahead and ask you a couple of questions so that you can get in touch with us. We would love to have some material from you in tomorrow's show on this topic. What does Southern hospitality mean to you? Really, how do you define it? Do you define it entirely as a positive, as we have primarily been discussing it here today, or do you see some negative aspects to it as well? And do you think that it is part of some intrinsic Southern identity, or do you think that it's something that is being diluted or changed by the massive influx of newcomers into places like Atlanta and to Athens? Get in touch with us at 404-500-9457, or we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can talk to us on Facebook. I've been joined by College of Charleston Professor Gibbs Knotts, April McLean of the Athens-based Etiquette School, Perfectly Polished, and Alfreda Lockett, Executive Chef of Meemaw's here in Macon. Thanks to you guys.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, the rise of hate crimes. It's on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. In recent months, we have heard more hate speech. And we've been seeing things like a Ku Klux Klan banner flying on a building in Dahlonega, Georgia. White supremacy is in the national news, too.
The alt-right movement is a white nationalist movement that's associated with racism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism. The alt-right used to exist mostly on the internet, but with the rise of Donald Trump and his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, the movement is starting to hold conferences.
So the question is, how should we respond? What should law enforcement do as white supremacy groups get more organized? Joining me from the Indiana Public Media Studios is Janine Bell. She's a professor of law at Indiana University. Hi, Janine.
Hi.
Thanks for being here with us. Also with us on the line is filmmaker Mike Ramsdell. He kept company with hate groups to produce the 2010 documentary, The Anatomy of Hate. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Janine, let me go to you. Do you buy the idea that white supremacist hate groups are on the rise in one respect or another, or is it just that the lens of media attention has focused on them for any number of reasons?
I think both are happening, meaning that they are both on the rise, and there's been increased attention to the fact that they're in existence. But they've always been with us, and the Southern Poverty Law Center has indicated that they've been on the rise for quite some time.
Mike, same question to you. Do you think that there really is a rise going on, or is it just that we're more paying attention?
Yeah, I would agree that it's both. I think that... you know, the thing that I, my understanding that draws people to these groups more than anything, more than even, you know, the quote-unquote hateful ideology, is fear. And fear has been pumped into this culture and this society at such a massive rate over the last decade, and it continues to increase, that as that fear continues to increase, people are going to look for more and more ways to react to that fear and a response to that fear. And unfortunately, these kinds of groups attract a lot of people.
Yeah, ideas about a threat to a so-called white America have been in circulation for a long time, but certainly those are some of the explicit themes of the most recent presidential election and some of the politics that are happening in Washington right now. Probably one of the most prominent white supremacists of our day is Richard Spencer. He's a founding figure of the alt-right movement, and he actually rejects the term white supremacist as applied to himself. He says that he's more of a separatist. Here's a clip. Here he is talking to NPR's Lakshmi Singh.
But you also believe that that people of different races inherently do not get along. Isn't that right?
I think world history believes that. I mean, I don't... It's not just my opinion. I don't see very many counterexamples.
Both of you guys, I'll start with Janine. I want to get your take. Do you buy that there is a meaningful distinction between white supremacy, which generally is, you know, everyone talks about that. Sorry, there's a consensus, a widespread consensus in the country that is bad. And then there's this sort of new kind of emergent idea that's creeping more into polite society, this almost kind of white separatism, this idea that people of common ancestry should endeavor to live together, much as they have in many places for a very long time. Janine, what do you think?
First of all, this is not a new idea. White separatism is not a new idea. White supremacists, who are frequently white separatists as well, have long called for a five-state white nation out west in which they lived alone, right, meaning whites alone, and people of color lived in the rest of the United States. So this is absolutely not new. And it's something that white supremacists have long advocated. And it's an attempt to carve out a space that isn't as loaded as white supremacy. But if you study hate crimes, white separatism is absolutely every bit as loaded. Because if you look at it logically, why is it that they want to remain separate? Right? Why is it they don't want to have anything to do with people who are different from themselves? And you see, within their reasoning, there is the idea that they're at the top of the food chain racially, and others are beneath them, which is the core idea of white supremacy.
Mike Ramsdell, in your research for your documentary, did you feel like you encountered any distinction, meaningful distinction, between white supremacy, the belief that whites are intrinsically better, and white separatism, the idea that a European identity is something to be preserved in a nation or even strengthened?
Yeah, it's, you know, that's one of the interesting things about being kind of taking a peek behind the curtain into the movement, is that there's so many different flags and banners that people wave to describe themselves. Christian identity groups who believe that it's, you know, written in the Bible that races should be separate, and the white race is superior. White supremacists, obviously, white separatists. I heard some people call themselves non-white extinctionists. It's just all different names for, yes, this belief that, well, you know, as the gentleman was saying in the clip, that races are not meant to be together, et cetera. And it's, there is no way that can be a nonviolent, or that can be a productive mindset, or that can't be looked at with the same kind of understanding of how hurtful and harmful those belief systems are. And I'll even take it to the next step of saying that what was most fascinating to me is that same kind of contention for other races that exists, that we see from the outside looking in, when you're inside, there's that same contention among the different white supremacy groups, you know, whether it's the Aryan Nations against, or the Christian identities. They all believe that their belief system is the correct one. And so right now they're kind of coagulated under this flag of white supremacists or white separatists against other races. But if you waved a magic wand tomorrow and gave them their own free state as they asked for, it would be a matter of moments before they were all in contention against each other. That's just the nature of that kind of thought process. And that's the thing about it that I think is the big flag that we all have to be aware of, is that it doesn't matter how it's labeled. History doesn't show that races don't get along. History shows that the more you try to separate them, the more you try to build walls, the more violent societies get. And that's the history we have to pay attention to.
I'm talking to Mike Ramsdell. He's a filmmaker who made a documentary in 2010 called The Anatomy of Hate. Also with us is Janine Bell, law professor at Indiana University. We're talking about the resurgence of white supremacy groups and what our response should be to it. Social response, law enforcement response. Typically, when we think of hate groups or white hate groups, white supremacy, I suppose the mind conjures up images of the KKK, large-scale syndicated, big hate groups that are conspicuous, that, you know, there's nothing more conspicuous than the KKK getup. Is that really what we're talking about still, Janine?
No. There are individuals who are entirely unaffiliated with any organized hate groups. Dylann Roof, for instance, was an individual who was not affiliated with an organized hate group, who murdered 9 individuals at a church in Charleston in 2015. So you're also talking about individuals who will burn a cross on a neighbor's lawn. You're talking about individuals who will put up flyers on professors' doors. So there are a wide number of actions that individuals may engage in that are not connected to organized groups.
I suppose it's analogous to what we're seeing in radical Islamic terrorism. Oh, I can't believe I just said that. It's the term that they always want everybody to use. But the idea that you have people who are, for example, inspired by ISIS, read about ISIS online, take action in their own communities that is inspired by that, but they don't have direct organizational links to any particular terrorist group. Is that a good analogy?
Yes, it is. In fact, white supremacist organizations a number of years ago started encouraging individuals to act as lone wolves, not encouraged by the organization, and go out and carry out the mission of the organization. One of those individuals in Bloomington many years ago killed...
Where you are in Indiana.
A graduate student on campus, a Korean graduate student. He also went to Chicago, killed a Northwestern basketball coach, Ricky Birdsong, shot at individuals in Champaign, Urbana. So... This is encouraged specifically by the organizations for them to go out and carry out the organization's mission, which is, in some cases, to rid the space of people of color.
Let's talk about solutions. In the 60s era of the civil rights movement, there were some new laws that helped strengthen the federal government's role to intervene with these kinds of problems. And then in 2009, President Obama increased penalties for federal hate crimes. Here in Georgia, there was a man who was arrested with an anthrax-like toxin, and his social media history shows ties to white supremacist forums online. Janine, what should law enforcement be doing differently today? Can we learn from our history and how we've dealt with hate groups or hate crimes in the past?
Yes, law enforcement organizations should be enforcing hate crime legislation to the extent that it exists in a particular jurisdiction. The vast majority of states have hate crime legislation. I, for instance, live in a state that does not have hate crime legislation. Mm-hmm. But most states do have some form of hate crime legislation, and individuals in the state would be better protected if law enforcement was active in investigating hate crime. That is everything from, you know, telling the community that hate crime exists. Many individuals who are targeted by hate crime don't even know that it's a crime to burn a cross on your lawn. They may be unaware of or worried about calling the police. And that's a situation where you need outreach by the police department with communities that are targeted by hate crime.
Mike Ramsdale, in the course of working on your documentary, The Anatomy of Hate, what solutions came to mind in your head as to how to integrate these folks more into the American mainstream and to steer them away from radicalism?
That's a great question, and I'm really happy to be able to kind of provide some insight onto what I saw. I'm not a legal expert, and I don't pretend to be, so I don't want to speak to any of those topics. But
no, but like socially.
Sure, socially. So, you know, many of those that I met, and I was at multiple rallies, I was at multiple cross burnings, and I was always, there as a filmmaker. People knew I wasn't part of the movement, but they opened up and they talked with me. And most of the people that I met, young white males, obviously, without any of the attributes that this society would call, of significance, meaning they didn't have the intellectual wherewithal to go on to college. They didn't have maybe the physical wherewithal to be star athletes. They were the misfits in their class. I don't know all of their family lives, but based on what I saw and interacted with, I wouldn't guess they came from the most caring and loving families. And when you're looking at yourself as a young male and you really don't have anything to give yourself significance in a culture that demands significance and demands excellence, it's a very easy step to just cross this line, and all of a sudden you put on a T-shirt that says something bad and you drink beer with some guys and you talk about being, they in the white supremacy movement, they have the 14 words, which I won't repeat here,
but it's the 14 words that they say, you know, that's their identity. Most of these guys would have, you know, 14 tattooed on them somewhere, but when I asked them what's the 14 words, they couldn't even repeat it. It wasn't a true hateful ideology. They weren't brought to it because of that. That was absolutely passionate about what they believe. They were brought to it because all of us are looking for some place to belong and exist. And I think you can draw, if you want to talk about drawing parallels to ISIS and to other violent, you know, to gang life in inner cities and things like that, that kind of desire to be associated with others, that kind of desire for acceptance and significance in a culture and society, you know, in this, and as we pump the society so full of fear and demand so much more of what it takes to be successful and give fewer opportunities to achieve that success, I think all of those things come together into one collective, and that's where you start to see what we're seeing. Now, I don't know that there's an easy answer to that, but sure, I don't think it is as scary as they're just evil, hateful people, and we need to get rid of them.
Got to give people something to belong to, and if not, they're going to find something themselves.
Absolutely.
That's Mike Ramsdell. He's a filmmaker. His documentary is called The Anatomy of Hate. We also talked there to Janine Bell, law professor at Indiana University. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
A comedy show in Atlanta this month sparks conversation about race, starting with the title of the show. And here it is: The Magic Negro and Other Blackity Blackness as Told by an African-American Man Who Also Happens to Be Black. It's written and performed by Mark Kendall. We spoke with him about developing this one-man show back in 2015. Celeste Headley asked what it's like to write about being black for white audiences.
So I guess you're trying to be clear most of the time. So it's just like I'm a black person, so it's like you experience race from like a certain perspective. So you try and think about someone that maybe has not gone through your first person perspective. One example is I had a sketch in the show, or I still have it. It's called White Guilt, where I like embody the idea of white guilt. So white guilt being like, you know, the guilt that people, the white people feel about their like
the history of slavery and institutional racism.
Yeah. So like I play a character that is white guilt. And originally I was like a little bit more aggressive with the audience and just saying like, oh man, you're feeling bad all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. And then I was testing it in front of someone and they're just like, you know, actually a lot of times it comes from like a good place, you know. I was just like, oh, I never really thought about it that way before, you know what I'm saying? So I used that to kind of like change up the angle that I took with that sketch.
Let's take another clip, take a listen to another clip from your show. Take a listen.
Sometimes my white friends, they walk up to me and they're like, Freddie, I don't understand. I don't understand how when me, a white person, says the N-word, I get in trouble. But Jerome over here, a black man, he says it, nothing happens. I don't understand how one person can be punished for doing something and another person is off the hook just because of their skin color. And to that I respond, you're finally understanding what it's like to be black.
That's Mark Kendall. His one-man show is at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta until April 15th. And that's our show for today, but we always want to hear from you. How does your family talk about race, or do they talk about it at all? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Celeste Headley. She'll be back at you tomorrow. Have a great day.